Welcome to VI Talk, sharing ideas, information and support.
Hi everyone, it's Jo here and I have Lacey with me as well. Hi Lacey.
Hiya.
And it's a pleasure to welcome to the VI Talk podcast for the first time, Haseeb Ahmad.
Hello.
Hi Haseeb, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me on today.
No, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure. So you obviously saw our advert asking for people to do interviews and kindly came forward. So you're visually impaired yourself, aren't you? So do you want to start off by telling us a little bit about your sight loss journey and what happened when you were a child?
Yeah, sure thing. So I noticed I was losing my eyesight probably about the age of 10. I mean, I was always a bit short-sighted. I got a pair of NHS glasses, you know, at the age of 5. My parents had picked up that my sight wasn't normal. So I wore these glasses for my short-sightedness. But it wasn't until I was sort of probably about 10 years old. I was going to boarding school at the time because my parents were abroad. My dad was a teacher. My brother and I, I've got a brother who's also visually impaired, and noticed the sight loss, tunnel vision, night blindness, but I couldn't really put my finger on it. I couldn't really figure out what was going on. And ball games became difficult. I was quite a keen footballer, loved my cricket, but those things became increasingly difficult. And also, even if I sat right at the front of the class, I found it quite difficult in those days. So I'm 53. So in those days, back in the 1980s, you had power overhead projectors, blackboards, and I couldn't even see those. I was struggling. But I could read a book. I could write, read my own handwriting. So things I could do, but gradually those things became more and more difficult. Then I changed school at the age of 12. And I went to an inner school, a comprehensive school, and things started to get from bad to worse from about 13 years old. My eye condition wasn't actually diagnosed until I was 17 years old. And I've got retinitis pigmentosa. Probably some of your listeners will have guessed the eye condition that I, myself, and my brother have got. I've got no useful sight now, but back then I did. And I mean, I was riding a bike until the age of about 16. As dodgy as that seems, you know, the light was okay. I could just about ride. But then it got to a point where even that became very difficult. And when we were diagnosed with VRP, I mean, it was actually my father who wanted me to have driving lessons at the age of 17. So I sat beside him. And he said to me, son, you know, you can get a provisional driving license. You can start getting lessons now. And I went, Dad, look, it's really bright. The sun's coming through the windscreen. I can't see a thing. The sun's glaring and I can't see a thing. I think the penny had dropped with him. And he found an ophthalmologist on Streatham High Street, London, who ran a few kind of run-of-the-mill tests on my brother and myself. And he used to be a consultant at St. Thomas's Eye Hospital down in London. And he suspected it was RP and sent us off for tests. And we got both registered blind straight away. That was how bad it was.
That must have been a real struggle at school. That must have been hugely difficult, you know. I'm guessing O-levels and CSEs and things. How did that go for you? And what support were you offered at school, if any?
Well, it went pretty badly at first. I started skipping school at the age of 13. So I'm not very proud of that, but I started playing truant in school because I couldn't cope in school, and school wasn't a particularly, it wasn't a great school either. And so I started doing that and spending a lot of time with a friend of mine whose parents actually knew that he was skipping school. He didn't like school. It was nothing, you know, he just couldn't cope with school. So, and he was different. I was different for the reasons I've given. So I started skipping. I skipped school for 2 years. Took some O-levels at the age of 15, managed to pass, miraculously, I managed to pass a couple of O-levels, stayed on. I got caught when I was 15 as well, playing truant. So I then went back to school and I stayed on to sixth form, did a few more O-levels and CSEs, and then started my A-levels at the age of 17. And it wasn't until the middle of my A-levels, the eye condition was diagnosed. That's when I started to get a bit of help from the school. So back then, it was a question of, I was doing A-level sociology, A-level economics. And I started A-level maths, but that became very difficult because that was all blackboard work. But I remember my sociology teacher being the first teacher that I told, Mr. Jones, and he was great. He was a great teacher. I really liked him. I liked his sense of humor. And I told him, and he said to me, he looked at me and he said to me, "You're joking." And I went, "No, I'm not joking. I'm probably going to go blind one day." And he used to photocopy, if anyone remembers the sociology textbooks, Haralambos.
Yes.
Haralambos was a.
Yeah, I do.
So he basically used to, the chapters out of it, he used to photocopy, but put it into large text. So he used to blow the text up for me. So that was immensely helpful. So I just want to go on to say that I did pass my A-levels. I didn't do incredibly well at that point. I did got a B in sociology, probably because of the enlarged text. I got an E in economics. But I went on then to go to Leicester Polytechnic. I got a place to study economics in 1988. But that year, there was no help for students with disabilities. There was no disabled student grant back in those days. So I went off at the age of 18 to Leicester from London. And to cut a very long story short, it didn't work out very well. It was a real car crash because my sight was deteriorating so fast I couldn't even read my own handwriting. I used to rely heavily upon friends to get me to and from lectures. I was so scared of venturing out by myself. And I had no means really to do my work properly. I didn't even have a tape recorder to take the lectures. I knew nothing about studying as a visually impaired person. So I had to drop out after a term and 4 weeks, which was quite upsetting. And then from there, effectively, I went back home quite upset. It was around about beginning of 1989. Took the rest of the year out, just really trying to sort myself out in terms of what I need to do next. And I got quite a lot of support. I had a couple of social workers who had visual impairments down in London. And one of them was called John Osborne and the other one was John Smith. And if people know him, they used to work for Lambeth Borough Council. And I think John's still around and he was immense, very supportive. And they just basically, because I knew that they were working, they had visual impairments. So I thought, well, actually, maybe I really ought to be thinking about doing something that I could do as a blind person. And social work was something that I felt that I could do. And so I went back to college, did a couple more A-levels, got myself a typewriter, got myself a tape recorder. I could read out of one eye. So I was reading out of one eye, literally, at this stage. 1990, something like that. It was 1990. I banged out a couple of A-levels in a year. Got an A and a B. So I kind of knew that I wasn't thick. Proved to myself, well, I'm not stupid. I've got something between my ears. And my dad was absolutely delighted. He couldn't believe it, to be honest with you. And which then allowed me to go back to university in 1990, the first year of Disabled Student Grant. And I came back to Leicester, actually. I went to Leicester University and I studied sociology then. And then the rest is history. I did okay after that, really, in terms of my education.
Going forwards, what got you into equality and diversity?
So it's a good question, Lacey. As you've heard, I kind of wanted to do social work. So when I was at the point of graduating, I applied to the School of Social Work to do social work. And I went for the interview and I fluffed the interview. And they said, look, go away, get yourself some work experience. I thought, how does a blind person get work experience, right? Who's going to employ me in the first place, right? So I kind of was thinking, what do I do next? And I applied to do a diploma in IT information technology because it was European social funded at the time. And it was like £400 a month. And I thought, well, that's an income. That's something to do while I'm thinking about what I do next. And it was boring as hell for me. I mean, people, you know, I mean, I know there's blind people that do IT and there's people who aren't blind that do IT and I love it. It wasn't for me. And I, in the middle of doing all that, a couple of jobs came up in the voluntary sector and I applied for those jobs. The first one I didn't get and the second one I did, which was for a charity called Fair Deal, which was an advocacy and empowerment project run by and for disabled people. So this is back in 94. And when I started that role, that job, I began to love, it was an equal ops organization. And I kind of really started to get into equal opportunities. And I was lucky enough to be funded by that organization to do a master's in policy, organization and changes to professional care at Loughborough University. At a time when the tuition fees or the fees for the course was £600 a year, you wouldn't hear about that. You know, it wouldn't be so cheap these days, but it's £600 a year.
No, definitely and, not.
And no charity would actually fund any course of that kind now. Back then, they funded it for me, day release, and on that course, I did a module on Equal Ops. And the lecturer was great. And I thought, I want to do that job. I want to do her job. So I did that for a couple of years. And in the mid, towards the end of that, actually, as I was kind of completing my dissertation, I did a dissertation on the Disability Discrimination Act at the time. And a job came up, an equality officer job came up at Charnwood Borough Council, which is based in Loughborough. I applied for that job and I mean, there's a story around it, but I mean, the quick version is I applied for it, I prepped for it and I nailed the interview and I got the job and I was there for 5 years and that set me off on the equal opportunities or equalities journey in terms of my career. And I've been doing that, for what? So I started that in 96 and I've had a number of EDI roles within local authorities, now in the NHS. I've been in the NHS for 10 years now. So, yeah, you can work out the sums.
That's fabulous, isn't it? After such a difficult start and, you know, no support to go on and, you know, have a successful career is no mean feat, is it?
I'm pinching myself still. I'll be honest with you. I'm quite honestly, I always pinch myself because I think, well, you know, obviously, clearly, you know, I had self-belief. I had hope. I never gave up. I always believed that things would work out. One of the things I really picked up more from my father, really, and I think this is how, you know, I think the family support is so important, is that he's always told me, and this is before actually even we were aware of my sight loss and my brother's sight losses, my dad would always say to me, stay optimistic, never be a pessimist, always be an optimist. So I've kind of kept that mantra, really, even when it gets really tough, whatever it might be, because everyone can go through ups and downs, you know, whether you're blind, disabled or not, or, you know, whatever background you're from, you know, things can get quite tough. But I think mentality is really important. But I couldn't tell you, actually, what differentiates somebody who is successful and somebody who's not, other than the fact that, you know, however many times you sort of fall over or whatever, you've got to get back up and you've got to give, you know, keep going with that self belief, determination, and, you know, trying to work out how to get to your destination by some other means. And I think I think and also luck as well, you know, obviously being in the right place at the right time. You know, if I'd been born somewhere else in a different place, in a different time, it could have been oh so different. So you know. So I think that's probably part of it, if you like. And technology's got better, hasn't it, as well, so that kind of helps.
Definitely. Yeah, it's opened a lot of doorways for all of us, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, also, you know, I think having a support worker, you know, I've had a support worker at work as well for many years, the better the support worker. And I mean, lucky for me also is that for the past number of years, I've been able to manage to get support workers paid a good salary. And then you get a better caliber of person, and you'll understand this yourselves, that, you know, the better they are, the more they can enable you to do your job properly.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're in a successful career. So all work and no play, as they say. So hobbies.
Well, I think for those people who do know me will know. I mean, you know, there might be one or two people who know me if they listen to this podcast. Will know that literally just kind of accidentally fell into triathlons a few years ago. So I always was quite sporty. I love, you know, you mentioned me, I mentioned myself getting onto my BMX bike and you know, cycling and things like that. And I used to just love, you know, going down the park and playing football. I never did anything really, really serious until I was kind of 15. I did some martial arts for a couple of years until that got dangerous. My sight was deteriorating to a point where sparring was a bit tricky. But then I kind of, all that seemed to fall to the wayside when I understood that I had a vision impairment, and I wasn't really sure, to be honest with you, what options or what avenues there were for sports. So I focused on my education, as you probably heard. And it wasn't until I started working, and I was working for Nottingham City Council at the time. Actually, I was traveling from Leicester to Nottingham, which is 30 miles each way, hour and a half, 3 hours a day of commuting, that I on a weekly basis, my hobby was to tandem ride with a friend of mine. Just a run-of-the-mill tandem, nothing special. And we used to go out for an hour and a half on a Saturday or a Sunday. It was a bit of exercise. It was a bit of a social. And I really enjoyed it. And then I said to my friend, who was on the front of the tandem, I really fancy trying to see whether I can run again, because as a kid I used to run around, I used to do some cross country, a bit of this, a bit of that. Sort of when I was 11 or 12 years old, I ran a couple of races for my school when I was at boarding school. But at this point, when I asked my friend, I was 38 years old, and I had a guide dog, and my guide dog loved to kind of leave the house, and then as soon as he got a bit of a straight sort of run, he loved to sort of like open up and started, you know, sprinting, and I'd jog beside him. But he'd only do it for 100 meters. So Usain Bolt of dogs. So I'll do it for 100 meters. I'm not doing any more. And it was great. I enjoyed it. And I said to my friend at the time, you know, I really fancy trying to get back into running. So he said, well, I can't run because I've got a dodgy knee, but I know somebody through church. I'll put you in contact, which he did. And this guy happened to be the president of the Leicester Triathlon Club. He went out for a run with me one day, and he was sort of running beside me, and he was huffing and he was puffing. And he was like, how's this for pacing? And I said, it's fine. I said, if you want to pick it up, we can go faster if you want. He goes, no, I can't go any faster than this. So, he said, but I know people who in the club would be able to run with you. And he organized a track session. And and I remember this guy coming up to me, and he shook my hand. At this time, I couldn't see at all. And I thought, wow, I felt his hand. I thought, oh, it's slight. He's, you know, must be a It must be someone in his 20s. He sounded young. And I was, as I said, 38 at the time. Turns out this chap's like 10 years older than me. And he was like a whippet. And he took me around this track. And I did, I think I must have done like a 6-minute mile. I was pretty whacked. So that's fairly quick.
Yeah.
And that's off the back of very little training. And so my friend Richard said, well, do you fancy an open water swim? You know, and I said, oh, let's give it a go in the middle of May when it's actually quite cold. So we went and he said, we can try and get a wetsuit that will fit you. You know, I can try and get a couple of wetsuits. We can try them on the day. And I thought, wow, this time I was working in Nottingham. I thought, now I'll just pop down. I don't want to kind of like, you know, any old wetsuit. I'll pop down to a shop in Nottingham. So I went down with my support worker on my lunch break and went to a shop which sold surfing gear and picked up a wetsuit for surfers, which is actually quite unsuitable for triathlon, and went to try it on. And my sport worker was female. She said to the shop assistant, if you get stuck in that, you're going in to take him out of that. Get him out of that. I'm not going in. Anyway, I found out this wetsuit was actually a little bit too big for me and it let in all the water, so it's actually quite useless. But when I went open water swimming, it must have been May 2008 with Richard, all the water went in, it was really cold. I started swimming around in circles, you know, because I was disorientated, getting tangled up in the tether. And my friend Richard he said to me, he said, stop swimming around in circles. And I said, Richard, I can't help it. And he had to basically do an emergency sort of maneuver to get me out of the water twice. But I went back week after week. He then became my swim coach because I was a terrible swimmer. I was awful. He saw my swim stroke and he said to me, that's interesting. Because there was no name for it. It was, you know, it wasn't a front crawl. It wasn't a breast. It was kind of like a combination of everything. Me thrashing around, somehow managing to get from one side to the other, but not particularly quickly. So he basically had to physically show me how to swim. And I had to break down my technique and build it all back up again. So he did that for me. And then 2009 came along. Oh, 2008, I did my first triathlon very slowly. And he said to me, you know, either you're going to love it or you're going to hate it. And if you love it, it'll be a bug. And I did my first triathlon at Woodhall Spa, which is in Lincolnshire, in must have been summer of 2008. And then 2009, I applied to get onto the development squad, got turned down first time. And then my luck, one of the females on the squad became pregnant. And she then gave up her space and I got offered a space on the development squad, the triathlon development squad. Wow. And I did my first international race, my first national race in 2009 and my first international race in 2010. And I was just picking up medals left, right and center. So I then went on after that to win the national champs in 2011 and get silver in the world championships. 2012 seemed to be a little bit of a non-year for me for some reason, which escapes me. But I was also doing a lot of running at the time. So I decided that I wanted to kind of like go long distance and do marathons because the triathlons I was doing were shorter distances. I mean, they're probably long distances for a lot of people, but in terms of triathlon and marathon running, there were short distances. So it was a 750 meter swim, for example, a 20 kilometer bike and a 5K run. Whereas a marathon is obviously 42 kilometers or 26.2 miles. So I was building up to a marathon and I did my first marathon in 2012. And I could have gone quicker, but my guide couldn't keep up with me. So I had to in the end just accept his pace. He started cramping at the end of that particular the Chester Marathon. which qualified me to do London in the following year. And in 2013, again, I did the World Championships and a number of races. And I found myself on the world-class GB squad in 2014, getting prepared for Rio 2016. So it was quite a rapid sort of, you know, if you think about it, although it seemed, you know, it seems like 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, a long time. In terms of sporting terms, it's actually not that long. And I did come into it quite late. So I was going from my late 30s into my early 40s. So it was quite an exciting time for me, but hard work, because I was working full-time training. And, you know, invariably, that meant that family sort of suffered a little bit, to be fair, because I'm married and I have a daughter. And so that was a bit tricky at the time. However, you know, they were very, very supportive, and they sometimes came with me along to some of the events, although I have to say my daughter found it very, very boring. She was quite young. Triathlon is not the most exciting sport to watch, you know, not like the 100 meters, it's over in 10 seconds or whatever, or however long the people do it, you know, but triathlons, you've got to be there for an hour or so, and depending on the distance, you know, it's not the most exciting. So I was set on this journey to go to Rio, but unfortunately in 2014 my classification didn't get included into Rio. So I came off the program 2014 when I had the most successful year. Unfortunately for me, I was at my height. I did really well. I got an international gold that year as well. I was again won a number of silver and gold medals, and I was well on the way. Quite competitive. There's at least four visually impaired males at that time who were very good. And we were competing against each other. So it was very competitive from the GB front. So it was really exciting times. And I even won an able-bodied race that year in my age category at the end of the year. That's how good my racing was at that time. So it was really, really good. But unfortunately, we didn't get to Rio. And I turned my mind to Ironman in 2015. So I started to train for an Ironman race, which is very long. It's 2.4 miles swim, followed by a 112 mile bike, and then a marathon at the end of that 26.2 mile run. And it's all done one after the other. So you don't get a break other than when you're transitioning in terms of your kit, going from your swim kit to your bike kit to your run kit. Because all the time counts. So I wasn't really satisfied with just doing an Ironman. I wanted to find out what the world record was. And there was no official Guinness Book of World Records record for an Ironman other than an unofficial time that an American visually impaired guy had set. And that was 11 hours 10 at that time. So I applied to the Guinness Book of World Records. It must have been early in 2016, and my record attempt was accepted, and I went for it on the 2nd of October 2016 with a guide, with my family there on the day that my daughter turned 20. She was there. We you know, as a team. So obviously I get the benefit of my guide on the tandem, the front of the tandem, but I still have to pedal. I broke the world record by 3 minutes. Well, so the record attempt was 11 hours, 10 minutes, 35 seconds. And I think I broke it. I think I went 11 hours, 7 minutes, and 28 seconds, but it was looking rather dodgy on the run at one stage. So at one stage, I was really suffering quite badly and it was quite warm. So it was, this was in Barcelona, we did this. It was a sea swim, and then the bike was a two-lap bike, but it was very warm. It was like 24 degrees. And then as the sun set on the run and as it cooled, I started to speed up again, and it was just exhilarating. And then when I finished, my daughter came up and she cried and she said, "Daddy, I'm so proud of you." And it was like, she's never said that since, but but it was nice. It was really special, really, really special. So that's kind of the journey, really. But it's, for me, you know, I learned a lot about myself. It gave me a lot of confidence. And I think, you know, when you're visually impaired, and the thing is, people make assumptions about you. They judge you. You know, even at work, they judge you. You know, "Oh, how do you do that? I do this." You know, "Oh, wow, aren't you amazing?" All this kind of stuff. Or they pigeonhole you, you know, like visually impaired people. Yeah, if you're visually impaired, you're bound to do EDI work, aren't you? That's what you're destined to do, that kind of attitude. And sports, it sort of levels the playing field. Although you need some help, some support, the thing is, even though the Ironman record officially is called the fastest blind Ironman blindfolded, because I had to be blindfolded throughout. But now, I mean, I'm focusing on running, and I'm running, and I'm doing league races against able-bodied people, and I'm coming sort of, even now at 53, I'm still the top sort of 10%, sometimes 5% of 700 runners, you know. So it gives you such a huge, it does me anyway. I've got another race coming up on Sunday, this Sunday. And I just so look forward to it. I just want the week to be over. It's really terrible. I'm like a kid. I'm like a child. "Oh, I'm going to be racing on Sunday. Yeah, bring it on." I think we've all got a child within us, and that's my inner child. And loved running when I was a kid, love running now. And it's great. You get so much respect as well, you know, from other people. You're that blind man, but actually, you're that blind man that's actually really fast. And people, seriously, people want to beat me, you know. I'm the target man for some of them, you know. But it's a great atmosphere. It's a great community. And I think for me, it's given me a lot of self-confidence. And I've learned a lot as well in terms of, you know, having guides and having to be a team and managing relationships. And you know what I mean? There's all those additional things you learn as a human being in terms of how you get on and how you make the most of life. And I know those people get so much out of it. So I've got a guide who's guiding me in a few weeks' time, on the 25th of June. And he is super fast. I mean, he comes top five in all the races, in the league races. That is quick. But he's sacrificing one of his races to guide me, because we've been friends, and he's
amazing, isn't it?
That is amazing. That is very, very special.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, and I know he'll get a lot out of it as well. And you know, so that's kind of my story, really, in terms of, you know, my life journey.
Life for you sounds pretty good at the moment. So it's not stopped, has it? You're still going. So that's amazing. That's brilliant.
Oh, I'll keep going until I drop.
It sounds like it.
Literally. I think it's really important. Body and mind is really, really important. For me, physical health is extremely important. I'm not super strict. Some people are, but I'm sensible. I have a balanced diet. But I do, you know, I love my Snickers. I love Snickers bars. And
is that your guilty pleasure?
After my marathons, my guilty pleasure is I'll have at least two Snickers bars. I have been known to eat through a whole pack of Snickers bars because I can, you know.
After all that running?
Exactly. Your body's like, "I want food." You're going to give your body food. It doesn't really matter. Carbs are good. carbs aren't good if you're not doing anything, but carbs are good after a, you know, a serious workout. Most of the times, actually, after a serious workout, I'll have a shake, you know, like a milkshake or something like that, because that's good for you. But after a race and all that, that's my little treat, you know. So I think, yeah, I mean, but for me, life is good. Life is good. Life is what you make it. And actually, you know, being fit and agile, don't get me wrong, I mean, I have all sorts of niggles and things going on in my body. You know, it's not, I'm not like, I don't get up in the morning, bounce out of bed like a 15-year-old or 20-year-old like I used to. These days it's like, oh God, oh, what's that? Oh, it's a bit of a bit. I have to do a bit of stretching and all that kind of stuff. But actually, because it enables me to go play, right?
Yeah.
play with the big boys. It's worth it for me, you know. But everybody, I think everybody should have something, you know, whether it's knitting, sewing, you know, I don't know, whatever, walking, swimming, whatever you want to, but being active, I think particularly if you're blind, being active is so incredibly important, you know what I mean? Because you never know when that's not going to be there. I'll tell you, when I was working for Fair Deal, there was an amazing, you know, and I call her amazing because she was a colleague and she was an inspiration to me. And her name was Jan. And she was the PA. She was the, you know, she could read. I can't read Braille very well, but she was proficient at Braille. Mm-hmm. And, but she was in an electric wheelchair. And she was probably in her 40s, maybe 50s back then, when I was in my 20s. And she was a strong woman, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I used to think to myself, how does she manage to stay so positive using a wheelchair and being totally blind? You know, she had a skeletal problem, problem with the spine, actually. Might be scoliosis or something like that. But she was incredible. And to me, I look to people like that and I think, wow, you know, I can do stuff. So I should do that stuff. You know, the stuff that I enjoy. If I can't do it anymore, I'll do something else, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So what would you say to somebody, perhaps somebody visually impaired who's perhaps starting their journey maybe, or who's perhaps thinking, you know, life's a challenge, what would be your words to them? What would be your top tip?
My top tip would be surround yourself with people who can give you sound advice, sound sensible advice about how to manage your vision impairment in a way that helps you to grow and develop. Because, you know, there's nothing like having people around you that have got belief in you, but that can point you in the right direction. Because I didn't know what I was doing, I'll be honest with you. I just didn't know what I was doing, but I just knew that actually there was more to life than, you know, I guess, not working or giving up and, you know, accepting my lot, which would have been easy to do. It would have been easy to do, but I don't think it was in my mentality, you know, like it wasn't in my mentality. So yeah, anyone who's new to sight loss, and everyone deals with things differently. I'm not judgmental. I don't judge people, you know. I let people get on with their lives. But if you really want to make the most of life, go out there. There's so many opportunities. Yes, you're going to encounter barriers. Yes, you're going to encounter negative attitudes and so on and so forth. But, you know, there's plenty of people who are blind and vision impaired who encounter all those things, but they then come at it in a constructive way and in a growth mindset way, you know. And I've recently started to listen to In Touch again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think some of the conversations on there are really good. I think, you know, there's a lot of sources of advice and support and, you know, great role models as well.
Yeah.
That's what I did anyway. I had a few role models around, you know. That's all you need. You need to know that actually, you know, there is a life which is bigger than the visual impairment, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Oh, wow. Sounds like great advice. Is there anything else that you'd like to add at this point?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I find talking about things like this quite cathartic. So thank you for the opportunity to allow me to express, because I'm still, yeah, I mean, the other thing is that learning never stops, right? I'm always learning all the time. Yeah, I'm never going to stop learning. I'm going to carry on as long as I can do it. Coming to the probably towards the end of my career, you know, I'm looking to retire in a few years' time, but I am, I've just recently, you know, I'm a trustee on a local charity for visually impaired people in Leicester. And I'm enjoying it, but I'm doing it because I want to help other people. So I think, you know, that personal growth is just so incredibly important, isn't it? Really. Life's so interesting. I just think it's really fascinating. And the more people I meet, the more kind of I learn from those people, and the more we can kind of influence, you know, I want to make society just more accessible for people who are vision impaired. And some of that's about awareness raising. So the more of us that could be those positive role models that can influence, you know, you've heard of social media influencers. We can be those influencers as well, you know? So, yeah. So that's what I'd like to happen, really.
Thank you, Haseeb. It's been lovely to talk to you. Thanks for sharing your story. And
pleasure.
Hopefully people will, you know, benefit from your experiences and from the advice that you've given as well.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to both of you, and great show.
Oh, thank you.
I'll keep on listening to it.